Welcome back. Thank you for tuning into this episode of What Do You Get? As always, I'm your host, Bo Trays. If this is your first episode, thank you for listening. I'm a professional tennis player, well, sort of like a minor league professional tennis player at this point. I'm ranked 1502 in the world. And my podcast called What Do You Get? It just focuses on mostly athletes this episode, not some musicians. And it's just, you know, what do you get out of what do you do, and why do you do what you do, is the whole point of this podcast. There's nothing else. I would love it for it to be a way for athletes to get their own story out there the way that they want it to be, and not by somebody who just writes an article about them from the stands or somebody who's criticizing them. This is just supposed to be why do you play and what do you get out of it, because that's what I get asked. So often of, what, you know, if you're 1502 in the world, you must be terrible. You know, when are you going to stop? You're not making any money. And so this is sort of a continual weekly answer to that question for myself, you know. And I love doing it because it's really a place I get to go every week and every conversation I have and learn something from somebody else, whether they're super successful in their field or not. You know, you just learn about a way that you want to live your life. And that's what's been big for me most recently, is trying to be the kind of guy and spend my time the way that I want to, you know. And sports is important and tennis is very important to me, but, you know, cancer still exists and people are still hungry and hurricanes are still ravaging other countries. You know, whether I have a good day or a bad day on the court really doesn't matter, except for to me. So I want to have fun with it, you know, and have a good time doing it, not feel like, oh, it's such a grind, this sucks, I don't want to do it, I wish I was doing something else. You know, because what you're doing is, can change so quickly, and what you have a chance to do can change so quickly. So I really want to be just enjoying where I'm at, you know, and learning to be that is hard, but I'm trying to implement that into my everyday practice and life and routines. And obviously I've been injured for the last 9 months, and it's the exact opposite of ideal. This is a life that I chose, and so I got to make the best out of it, you know. And it's a great life. It's absolutely very lucky that I get to do what I do, you know. And so my podcast is just supposed to be spotlighting athletes, and so is the rest of my website. I'm sure you can check out the articles I've written on there, and you'll really get to know me and what I stand for as an athlete and as a person. Without further ado, though, this episode with Richard Musio is awesome. I'm so sorry that the quality is so bad. I don't know what happened, because when we talked, it was fine. So whatever the app I was using to record the conversation made it so, it sounds like there's a bad connection. It sucks. But the interview is so interesting, and with Battle of the Sexes, that new movie with Steve Carell and Emma Stone coming out, I just couldn't not, you know, put this up. So I hope you listen to it, and I hope you stick through it, because Richard is a fascinating guy. He was the scrapbook maker for Bobby Riggs. Bobby Riggs was former world number one, Wimbledon champion, and he played in the Mother's Day Massacre, where he beat Margaret Court, and then he played in the Battle of the Sexes, where he ended up losing to Billie Jean King. So he just has so much to talk about, and then he has so much to talk about with his charity, the Oceanside Turkey Trot, that he holds out in California. He's just an awesome guy, and I hope you will listen to the whole episode if you can get through the sound. I know the sound sucks. But before I start, I'd like to give a big shout out to my sponsors, Gun Athletic, the clothing company. I'm sure you guys saw Jules Roger is also a part of the team, and he won the men's doubles at the U.S. Open this weekend and had an awesome statement at the trophy ceremony. My string sponsor, Solinco. There's still free string out there for you if you're listening. Message me on Instagram or Facebook. or Twitter, and I can send you some free string from Selenco. So all you gotta do is message me. And Vitalite, my supplement sponsor. It's like Gatorade, except for that it really works. It's awesome. It's all I use down here in Florida. That and water. It's great. And all my sponsors are really sticking with me through this injury, and they really believe in my podcast and my website and what I have to say about sports as a current athlete in the world right now. So a big thank you to all of them. And without further ado, again, here is episode 5 of What Do You Get with Richard Muccio.
I'd love to hear your take on the Mother's Day Massacre. I obviously wasn't around for that, really, but being a kid and being Bobby Riggs' scrapbook maker, what was that like for you, just being there? Were you aware of all the male versus female dynamic and everything that it really ended up meaning? Or to you, was it just sort of following Bobby around and this was just one more event?
So here's the story. When I was 14 years old, which is 1973, I got hired to be Bobby Riggs' scrapbook maker. And 1973 was at the height of the Women's Liberation Movement, which was following on the heels of the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I got hired as a scrapbook maker because he lost his scrapbook maker, who happened to be his girlfriend, and they broke up. And she was also Bobby Riggs' scrapbook maker. And of all the strange things, my late father's only sibling, my late Aunt Marion, who we call Auntie Bun, married one of Bobby Riggs' brothers. She married John Riggs, who was Bobby's older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And John Riggs sort of functioned as Bobby's de facto assistant manager. Bobby had a manager up in Beverly Hills, but his brother John Riggs, my uncle by marriage, handled a lot of day-to-day detail for him, since Bobby wasn't good with detail. So I got a call one day asking if I knew how to make scrapbooks. This would be in early 73.
Okay.
And I was 14 years old and in high school, and I didn't have a job, and this is a paid position, so I was actually on Bobby Riggs' staff. And so I said, well, of course I know how to make scrapbooks, even though I didn't. I mean, I'd never really seen a scrapbook. It wasn't too hard to figure out what to do with paper and glue. And so I became his scrapbook maker around February 73, which was about 3 months before the first famous tennis match, which most people have never heard of or have forgotten about, because the second match so dwarfs it by comparison, became so much bigger. But the first match was on Mother's Day of 73 against Margaret Court. Bobby Riggs had been trying to get Billie Jean King to play him for about 2 years, and Billie Jean had been ignoring Bobby because she was busy getting the Women's Professional Tennis Tournament started, which ironically was sponsored by Philip Morris, the cigarette company in the early days, known as the Virginia Slims. They had their tagline was, "You've come a long way, baby." But so Billie Jean was just too busy to take Bobby up on it, and she wasn't taking him seriously. And she was actually the number two player in the world. Margaret Court was actually number one. Margaret, I think, lifetime had a record of something like 21-12 against Billie Jean.
Mm-hmm.
But Margaret did not believe in the Women's Liberation Movement. Billie Jean King, of course, was by far and away the most outspoken female athlete on the Women's Liberation Movement at the time, tennis or otherwise. And so since she was the one who was always in the news saying that the women players should get paid as much as the men's players, and since Bobby was desirous of getting back in the limelight, he was at the time 55 years old, and he, of course, was former number one in the world back in 1939. He won at Wimbledon the men's singles, the mixed doubles, as well as the men's doubles, only men in history doing all those three in the same year. He was desirous of getting back in the limelight and trying to make some money by this whole situation. But Billie Jean just ignored him. But Margaret Court said, hey, you know what, I'll take you up for $5,000. Well, not for $5,000, that's what Bobby offered. And she said, I'll take you up for $5,000 times two, if you guarantee me $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'll play you. And so the Mother's Day Massacre was born, and that was played on Mother's Day, which was May 13th of 1973, out in the middle of nowhere in North County of San Diego, a place called San Diego Country Estates, which is in a town called Ramona, which is still pretty much in the middle of nowhere. And so I was a scrapbook maker for all of this. And so when this was announced about 3 months before the match, the newspaper and magazine articles just started, you know, just piling up. I mean, every major newspaper and magazine started reporting on this. Everything was in paper form back then. And Bobby subscribed to what were known as clipping services, but they're sort of a misnomer. They didn't actually clip the articles out of the magazines or newspapers. They would just send the whole thing. Uh-huh. So it was my job to put the articles out and place them in scrapbooks.
Okay.
And so I started doing that a little bit before Mother's Day of 73, about 3 months before. And the scrapbook started building and building. And, of course, Bobby Riggs killed Margaret Court in that match. He beat her 66-1.
Yeah.
And the match didn't even take an hour. It was estimated to be about 10 million TV viewers. There were maybe 3,000 people in the stands up at San Diego Country of Space. It was a big deal. But, again, as I'll mention, it was nowhere near the size of what the Battle of the Sexes became. So Bobby, having defeated the number one player in the world in the Mother's Day Massacre, Billie Jean now, was in a position where she could no longer avoid Bobby.
Right.
And so she had to take on the challenge. And that's what became what's now known as the Battle of the Sexes, which was played down in the Houston Astrodome on September 20th, 73. And, of course, Billie Jean King beat Bobby in that. But once Billie Jean committed to that, shortly after Margaret Court lost to Bobby, if you thought there was a lot of newspaper and magazine articles about what was going on with Bobby Riggs and him playing the best women tennis players in the world, it was like times 10 once Billie Jean committed. And we knew
right.
It was going to be about. And so the scrapbooks wound up being, if you stack them on top, they're on 11 by 17 paper. And if you stack them all up, they wound up being taller than me. I'm 62 inches tall. If you stack them from end to end, they're probably 7 to 8 people.
Oh, my God.
Now, I mean, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, how much material. Because this was by far and away the most significant sporting event during the women's liberation movement. The only really significant event between the pit and a man against a woman, those two tennis matches. So
right.
It was huge in terms of the media coverage.
Right.
That's my job. And so I created these things, which are now the property of the Bobby Riggs Foundation and the Bobby Riggs Tennis Company, to document all that was going on in 1973 and thereafter. I continued working for Bobby in 74, 75, 76. After he lost to Billie Jean, he made a living by just getting paid to go out and promote events and do things all around the world where people would pay him to watch him do all of his corny tricks, like, you know, play tennis against the entire Australian men's rugby team, or play a match while to hold two dogs on a leash against somebody. I mean, he did all these bizarre things to make money.
Yeah.
When he lost to Billie Jean, that basically put him out of business. His plan was then to go on after he beat Billie Jean, which he didn't. His plan was then to go on and to challenge Chris Everett, who at the time was only 18 or 19, and the up-and-coming star of women's tennis, to the next exhibition match where everybody would guarantee at least $1 million. The Battle of the Sexes, that's worth the Mother's Day Massacre. There was 30,470 people at the Houston Astrodome. I attended both matches, which is to this day the largest live tennis audience here in the United States in history.
I was reading that. That's amazing.
Yeah, estimated that worldwide television viewing was 90 million, which TV ratings on Battle of the Sexes actually were higher than the most highly rated Monday Night Football game history. Monday Night Football was a big deal back then. But even their highest rated game didn't surpass the TV ratings for the Battle of the Sexes. Now, of course, all of this is back in the news because Billie Jean King recently, along with Fox Studios, announced that on September 22nd, less than a month away, the new Battle of the Sexes movie is going to be rolled out nationwide, where Emma Stone is playing Billie Jean King and Steve Carell of The Office fame is playing Bobby Riggs. So it's all back in the news because of the fact that this big deal movie's being rolled out here in less than a month.
And
so it's a story that won't go away 44 years later, but it's an amazing story because I was there documenting the whole thing.
Right, and what was that like for you? What was your impression of it just as a kid?
Well, my impression was that nobody could tell or know how significant this might be. I was aware that it was significant because I'd never seen such a volume of newspaper articles and magazine articles. The interesting thing for me, though, was because the clipping services didn't actually clip the articles out, I had to clip them out and then glue them into scrapbooks. It would take about 2 minutes for the glue to dry, and there's articles on either side of the page throughout these scrapbooks. So I had a lot of time on my hands when I was doing the work because I couldn't just glue an article in, cut out another one, and glue it in. I had to glue one in, let the glue dry. So I was reading back in 1973 all of these newspapers and magazines because I've always loved to read. And 1973 was just an amazing year of significant change. I was reading about the end of the Vietnam War, the start of Watergate, the first ever OPEC oil embargo against the West, 1972, the previous year, Title IX had been born, so there was news coming out on Title IX and how that might be implemented at colleges with regard to women's equal rights, for example, with college scholarships for athletics, Roe versus Wade, famous case. I mean, it just went on and on.
I mean, what a time to have time to read.
Exactly. My wife jokes that you can't take me to parties because if she does, I just start talking to people about 1973, and it's embarrassing.
You know more about 1973 than anybody.
Yeah, if you ever play Trivial Pursuit and you get 1973 to talk, call me really quick because I guarantee you're going to get them in.
I'm
going
to
because it was an amazing year. And I read all about it. And for whatever reason, this is my DNA. I can't seem to forget any of it.
Right.
That's why I can go on about it. But there was no way to know at the time that it was going to be significant the way it's become significant. I mean, you know, it was a big deal. The tennis matches were a big deal. I knew that much. It was interesting to me as a boy, I was 14 and 15 years old, that all of this was so important. But I was able to put two and two together. I mean, at my high school, for example, I was on the boys' basketball team. There was no girls' basketball team. By the time I graduated in 1976, there was a girls' basketball team.
Wow.
So it was obvious that things were changing, but I don't think anybody could have guessed how significant this all would have become. It became significant in part because of Billie Jean King's amazing accomplishments going on from that era and that time to not only be a champion of women's rights, but subsequently to be one of the leading spokespeople and leading athletes speaking out for LGBT rights. And of course, she won a Presidential Medal of Freedom award from President Obama a few years ago. She's obviously one of the greatest contributors to equality and diversity in this country that has ever existed. You know, if her career had taken a different trajectory or her life had taken a different trajectory, this might not be that newsworthy, but she's really just kept moving forward and accomplishing amazing things, not only as a tennis player, but as a human being in terms of the work that she did to help others, you know, who had been discriminated against, get women and LGBT or anybody else who didn't have a voice. So looking back, and that's why I wrote a book about it, at the 40th anniversary in 2013. I wasn't really able to put it in perspective until 40 years later when I wrote my own book about those experiences when the 40th anniversary documentary was coming out. About the Bat Sexes, where I was a consultant for New Black Films in London on the project, and that's when I wrote my own book, because I just wanted to sort of get my own perspective out on it. And the thing that's always stuck with me, though, is how Margaret Court gets no credit in the whole story, and in fact is spoken negatively about because of the fact that she got killed by Bobby. The irony is that Margaret Court not only didn't believe in women's liberation movement, she was overtly against everything that Billie Jean stood for and wasn't shy about saying that. And to this day, isn't shy about saying that. She, again, stuck her foot in her mouth, so to speak, at Wimbledon. She made some comments that were, I think most people would agree, were inappropriate. And so it's ironic to me that a woman who not only didn't believe in women's liberation but was actually overtly against it was one of the catalysts for it. even though that certainly wasn't her intention. Her intention was to make $10,000, which was more than she could make playing any tournament at that time. And yet she played a role in this amazing chain of events that, you know, we're still talking about 44 years later because a major movie starring Emma Stone and Steve Carell is coming out about it. So it's a story that I think will never, ever lose its interest because it has to pan out. You know, equality still doesn't exist. There's still so much to fight for, not only in the U.S., but in particular, more so in a lot of other countries.
That's amazing.
So I can't take any credit for understanding the significance of it back when I was 14 and 50. There's no way to put that in context.
Right. And I listened to an interview with you where you had said that you went to collect your payment from Bobby, and he said, oh, okay, let's play double or nothing. And so you chose to play him in ping pong, and you ended up winning, and so your pay went from 500 to 1,000. And that's a funny insight to Bobby. But when you were working with him and then at these events, did you get to know Bobby or Billie Jean and Margaret in any way? And was there anything that you picked up from those three people who are such you know, such so extraordinary at what they chose to do. You know, they were at the top of their sport, all three of them. Was there anything that you picked up that you're like, wow, this is what other people don't do, or anything like that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there is from all three of them. Bobby, I knew much better than either Margaret or Billy Dean because of being my uncle's brother. I spent a lot of time with Bobby outside of the context of being a scrapbook maker. My uncle John and my auntie Glenn didn't have any children of their own, so they had two favorite nephews. I was one of them, and then Larry Riggs, one of Bobby's sons, was the other. So I spent a lot of time with my uncle John Riggs, who spent a lot of time with his brother Bobby Riggs, and so I would sometimes tag along with those guys to go play golf when I was a kid or do other things or hang out at senior tennis events because Bobby was number one in the world in the men's 55s at that time. So I'd go to La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club with my uncle to watch Bobby play in tournaments. And the thing I learned from Bobby, and I guess it's the thing that I learned from the Double or Nothing story, when he asked me that, I knew without anybody having to tell me that I couldn't say, no, I can't do that. I want my money. I can't risk, you know, getting no money or taking on your bet. And so I learned, I guess, the lesson of how you've got to accomplish anything, you've got to take action. You can't sit around and think all day about, well, should I go play Bobby in table tennis or should I not?
Right.
And, you know, his world moved so fast that I didn't give him an instantaneous response, you know, 5 seconds or less. You know, you can't really be in his world. Because he gambled or he bet on everything.
Yeah.
I don't mean outside sport. You know, he bet on his golf and he bet on his tennis and he bet on everything. So, you know, I understood, I guess, when he asked me the question that no wasn't an answer, that I had to say yes. The choice I had was which, you know, thing did we want to do? What was that? Was it shooting?
You want to play rock, paper, scissors, shoot, or ping pong?
Yeah, do you want free throws or go do chipping contest at the golf course or what do I want to do? And so I learned from Bobby that action, and I wrote about that in my book, that nothing really happens without action. He was all about action. I wrote, so what's your play? Because that's what he would say to people. But he would say, so what's your play when he was doing a bet? In other words, bet on something, what is it that you want to bet on?
Okay.
And play also meant how much money are we betting to him? So that's why I called my book, so what's your play? That's what he said to me. He said, okay, get double or nothing, so what's your play? You know, what are we going to bet on? And so he was all about action and taking action, and I learned from him that there's two ways you can live your life. You can sit around all day watching other people do things, or you can go out and do things yourself. And so it was neat being around somebody who just did that.
And was it hard to put that into your life where – I don't know exactly what Bobby Riggs is like, but I mean, at least in tennis, when I've been around much better players, right, they play with just an intensity and they practice with such a motivation that you, when you see something like that, you're like, okay, I got to be like this every day. But then 2 weeks later, when you're back at your house and you're just doing your normal thing, you can sort of revert back to what you're used to. You know what I mean? And was it to adopt that mentality when you're not always around Bobby like that?
No, it wasn't, because if you ask anybody who knows me, they'll tell you I never slow down or sit down. I'm always out doing things, some work and some fail. But he was the person that I first really witnessed that, and I liked it. I liked how it felt, and I still like how it feels to be doing things that I think are meaningful or to be trying to do anything that I think are meaningful. But he was the first person I... And he's one of the very few people I've actually witnessed this from. And I like how it feels. You can tell from looking at my different websites and the things I do that I do a lot of different things.
Right.
And that goes all the way back to that time. Because before I took on the job as a scrapbook maker, I was just a regular kid who liked sitting around basically not doing much to me.
That's amazing.
And so that's what I learned from him. And to this day, I'm that way. And, you know, I guess, you know, a lot of people like the fact that I'm that way, and some people can't stand the fact that I never sit down. You know, I haven't tasted coffee in my lifetime. I don't consume caffeine, but my wife says if I drank coffee, I would absolutely never even sit down. Wanting to do things, trying new things, meet new people, and that was Bobby personified, and that's where that came from. As far as Margaret Court and Billie Jean goes, I don't really know Margaret Court, but you know Billie Jean King. Billie Jean forever owe me a favor that she never repaid, because I'm the guy who found the lost footage of the Mother's Day Massacre that she'd never seen. It had been lost for 40 years. And But what I learned from her, obviously, a lot of the things that I talk about, diversity and inclusion, that's what she's all about. It's the exact opposite of what Margaret Court's all about. And so I learned from both of them that I think Billie Jean's way is a much, much better way than is Margaret Court's. Billie Jean, I mean, her message, it makes so much more sense to me, too. And it did at the time when I was younger. I mean, she was talking about things that I found fascinating when I was 14 and 15. Whereas Margaret Court was talking about things that I didn't find fascinating. You know, Margaret Court even said that the women shouldn't have their own professional tour. They should be, you know, men's tournament, which is what it was at the time. Because the women going out on their own would promote homosexuality. And even at 14 and 15, I thought, boy, that's a really odd thing to say.
That's amazing. For someone that got to the top to then say that is just, you would never think someone would say that.
No, you wouldn't, but you did. And she sort of said something similar at Wimbledon this year, so nothing has changed.
I didn't hear what she said at Wimbledon.
Well, look it up. I mean, I don't want to, again, I give her a lot of credit for having the guts to play by ear.
Okay.
And she basically continues to tell the same story.
Right.
And it attracted, you know, Martina Navratilova spoke out against her at Wimbledon, said that they should change the name of the stadium down in Australia where the Australian Open is played. They shouldn't let her name be on it. She put up Yvonne Gourigan's name or somebody else's name. And I don't want to denigrate Margaret, because I believe everybody's entitled to their own beliefs and opinions.
Yeah.
And free to state them. But I certainly don't agree with where she's coming from.
Right.
Whereas Billie Jean's story about diversity and inclusion makes much, much more sense anyway. And it did to me at the time, too, even though when I was 14 and 15, it was more of a, a response to, one sounds better than the other. Now I understand what people are saying much more clearly.
Right. And so when you're done with 1973 and you're still 14 or 15 years old, what did you then decide that you wanted to do with your life? Going to did that have this overall ability in shaping what you wanted to do with your life, or was that just sort of a very cool year and a very cool job to be with Bobby like that, and then you just went on and did your own life anyway?
Well, then I went on to graduate high school. I think because I had gotten so good at reading, I wound up being a class valedictorian because too many scrapbooks I became. So, I take six classes in high school and I wouldn't have to study because I'd been reading about it, at my job. And then I went on to become a college graduate, and my professional career is as certified public accountant. But all of these events from 1973 sort of determined the direction I went with everything that I do. For example, as a certified public accountant, I have a rather unique specialty. I don't do income tax returns or prepare financial statements, the things that most people would traditionally associate with accountants. I've got a unique practice where I represent taxpayers who are being discriminated against under the Internal Revenue Code. So, for example, in the 1990s and early 2000s, worked on a lot of cases where same-sex couples were denied treatment under the Internal Revenue Code that that heterosexual couples had. And so it sort of defined my career in terms of the kind of work I do with, heterosexual couples. The present case I'm working on now is for a group of about 150 retired women entrepreneurs who are being denied the same income tax treatment on retirement payments that was hired insurance salesmen are granted under the Internal Revenue Code simply because they aren't retired insurance salesmen. They're retired women entrepreneurs. So it's those kinds of, equal rights or discrimination cases that I focus on as a CPA, working primarily in tax court, which is a special court that hears complaints here in this country. So I go back to 1973 and I say, well, if I hadn't been through all of that, I probably wouldn't have gone off in this specialized direction as a CPA where I am representing the rights of people who otherwise don't have a voice or are being discriminated against by the Internal Revenue Code because of their sex or their sexual preference or whatever the case may be. So certainly it affected my career. It also affected the work, what I learned 40 years ago, affected the work that I do with my own foundation, which is a big Thanksgiving morning charity running event.
Right.
In the north county of San Diego, called the Oceanside Turkey Trot.
when you're a CPA for, you know, the cases that you're working on now, of course, my podcast is called What Do You Get, right? And so it's you know, why do you do what you do? And so what I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I assume you feel good about the work that you do fighting for equality and the certain rights that these different cases need, and you like being the person that can give them that?
I feel good about the fact that I get things that are unsolicited from the people I represent, like written notes. Most of my clients being retired women entrepreneurs tend to be older, over the age of 70, for example. So we'll write thank letters and things saying how much of a difference I've met, you know, in their lives, like helping them, you know, with specialized needs that they have that a typical CPA or even a typical tax attorney couldn't handle because they don't specialize in it. It just feels good to have people recognize you and thank you for something that you've done that makes their life better. You know, one woman, for example, we saved her about $20,000 a year of what otherwise would have been self-employment tax for a 15-year period, you know, $300,000. It's a significant amount of money, but also, you know, because of the age and the health of her husband and the fact that he had to go and do an assisted living home because he has the onset of Alzheimer's, then that's very expensive. You know, the fact that you've helped somebody be able to position themselves financially to be able to handle those things, whereas if they just get the $300,000 from the government, they couldn't have put her husband in good care. And then she writes me a lovely thank you note saying that I was the only one who just stuck through the whole, you know, the whole mess with her for 3 years fighting the government to win. And, you know, I was the guy who wouldn't give up. And you know, and I didn't charge her an arm and a leg. I just charged what I normally charge. It's not like I got rich doing that. You see what I'm saying? I got standard rate. You know, which is, you know, nobody ever thanked me for doing a good job on their tax return when I was younger. You know what I'm saying? Just sort of, I'll give you some money, you prepare my taxes. That's the end of the relationship.
Right.
And so, you know, people say, wow, you really made a difference in our lives. There's no amount of money that I would trade that for.
Right.
And it happens all the time. And that's the cool thing about it.
That's awesome.
It goes back to my experiences from 40 years ago because, I wouldn't be doing this kind of work if those events hadn't shaped what I believe in to be right and correct. But the unique thing is my foundation, those experiences, it affected what we decided to do with my foundation as well. And, you know, we're now the eighth largest Thanksgiving morning charity event in the country. According to the Wall Street Journal, I think the day after Thanksgiving of last year, our lead spokeswoman, Ann Garrett, was featured. She's an amazing person. She took up running at the age of 72.
I saw that. I saw her being prominent on your website, so I started looking at it. That's amazing. Those videos that you have of her running with those kids, and I've seen it since 2007. You raised more than $270,000 for local schools. I mean, that's amazing. And what gave you, from being a CPA, what got you to start that foundation?
Well, that's a funny story. I had a health issue. So in 1995, I lost sight in one eye when my older daughter accidentally kicked me in the eye. She was only 3 years old. And then 6 years later, I had a series of retinal tears in the other eye. So in 2001, I couldn't see. As I say, in baseball, I was 0 for 2. And I was not a runner, a tennis player and a baseball player, in terms of what I did for fun. And so I had to have a bunch of eye surgeries over about 15 months to get my eyesight back. And I gained about 40 pounds because I couldn't exercise. I had to actually lie still, motionless on my right side for 12 hours out of every 24 for 90 straight days so that scar tissue wouldn't form and cause me to lose my eyesight totally and permanently. And so when you're in your earlier mid-40s and you can't exercise for a year, eating weight, even if you're not eating because your metabolism like this slows down to zero. And so when I got my eyesight back, I wasn't worried about losing weight because I knew if I went out and did some exercise or stuff. But I then, you know, had a physical, and my doctor says, well, now you need medication for high blood pressure and high cholesterol. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to take medication. You know, I don't even drink coffee or alcohol. I don't want to take pills. What do I have to do? So I don't have to take meds. He says, well, you got to take up running or jogging. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I'm a, you know, in baseball, I was a pitcher. That's why I got outfielders to go, right?
Yeah.
Not me. And, you know, you're a tennis player. If I'm a tennis player and you're running, that means you're losing. You want your opponent to be running, right?
If you're running,
if you build
your game around running, you're in trouble.
Yeah, if you're running, you're going to lose that match. Again, she goes, live by the beach, jog for 5 minutes and walk for 5 minutes, jog for five, walk for five, turn around and come back. I said, okay, I'll try it. But I started losing weight, but then I decided to run a 5K after I lost some weight, and it turned out I was pretty good at it because I'm a pretty good athlete.
Yeah.
So I just thought, you know, I put this story out in the community about the importance of everyday physical activity and healthy eating. And you're in Oceanside, North County of San Diego, is a really underserved community because it has a rather low-income demographic. And so myself and a friend of mine, Kathy Kinane, who's an event director, we said, we want to do an event in Oceanside. And so we did. So anyway, we said, we're going to focus in an underserved community, just to promote everyday physical activity and you know, healthy eating. And so our first race, we got our 12th year coming up, our first race was in 06, maybe 2,500 people. But we said, we want to do something that's different than what other running events do. I don't know if you ever participate in 5Ks, but almost all 5Ks, they benefit a charity. So if you have, you know, in the cancer cause, you go do one of the great Super G Corona events, you know, a great charity. But if you don't happen to believe in that cause, it's not that relevant. Or if your church puts on an event to raise money. But, you know, if you don't happen to believe in that, it's not so relevant to you unless you're just an avid runner. And we said, let's do this. We said, there's a bunch of charities in Oceanside. They're all really small, really fledgling charities. Let's ask them to encourage people to come out to the event by contributing a portion of every runner's entry fee to the charity that causes the runner to come in the event. In other words, they don't create teams, and we'll get as many charities in our community on our platform as possible, and we'll promote this as an event that benefits the whole community, not just a single charity in our community. It was just some, you know, weird idea we had. And we started doing that, and people just latched onto it. Like, 700 runners, we raise this much money for our charity, and if we do our own event, we raise even more, we get it all, you guys don't get any. We're like, yeah, you just raise money off our platform. Because what we want is runners. Because that's what our sponsors and vendors want. They want tons of people out there if they're selling running shoes or sunglasses or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what we did, and the community just took to it. And, you know, I'd like to take credit for it. My joke is, if it worked, it must have been a plan. Well, it works, but it didn't start out. Like, that's what we want to do. We just said, let's try this idea because, you know, we didn't want to raise money for our own foundation. What would we do with it? We don't want to run programs or do other things.
Yeah. There's
plenty of great already running programs like the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Clubs and so on. And so we just tried that, and it just took off. And so we went from 2,500 runners in the first year to 3,000 to 4,000 to 5,000 to 6,000. Now, I guess, according to those. Runner's World, one of the magazines, were the 8th largest Thanksgiving morning charity event in the country in this little town in the North County of San Diego, Oceanside. But it's because we've got dozens of charities on our platform that benefit the community that our runners live and work in. And the other cool thing, and this is where, again, I say, if it wasn't have been a plan, we didn't even think about this. But the real cool thing, and this goes back to 1973, the Mother's Day Massacre, and that is the second for me, because we have 60 or 70 different charities that basically drive the population of runners that come to our event.
Mm-hmm.
We probably have the most diverse running event in the country, though, because the people who come out support all these different causes. And so
right.
People are all different. They're rich, they're poor, they're black, they're white, they're Asian, they're Hispanic, they're gay, they're straight, they're, you know, they believe in God, they don't believe in God. I mean, whatever. I mean, they're everything under the sun, which is what our community is.
Right.
But what it does is it puts everybody out together who's different, doing the same thing, benefiting their community. So what's served to accomplish is, you know, 20 years ago in that community, there were some serious issues with prejudice and intolerance. Those issues, you don't really see that anymore because people are all out together benefiting their community, regardless of who they voted for, who they sleep with. And they realize their stuff doesn't matter. And so, again, I'd love to take credit for that, but that was a pure accident. But because we don't just benefit one, because I've noticed this, you know, I'm an avid runner, so I'll go run an event that benefits from charity. You don't get a really diverse crowd.
Right.
Because
you
tend to get
the same people.
It's your charity who tend to have a lot of similarities. And I'm not being critical. Still a great charity. Still to go out and move your feet before you eat. But it doesn't promote diversity. And I look at that and I go, this is bizarre. My life is like a full circle because I learned all of this 40 years. We've all been raised with this idea that we're supposed to be competitive instead of collaborative. And, you know, that's one thing I don't believe in. I believe in collaboration, not competition. And that's why my Oceanside Turkey Trot does what it does the way it does it. You don't want to compete with other charities. And it works.
Your idea about collaboration instead of competition, do you think that can be put into sports to young kids and even at a professional level? Just about I always sort of go back to them calling it macho, just the aura of sports, that you have to be the king and that you have to be, you know, if you win, you're so hardworking and so tough and all that stuff, and then if you lose, you know, there's an inherent moral flaw in your being, right? If you lose, you know, in a third set, right, or if you lose 0-0, whatever. Obviously, there is not, but it seems like there is when you turn on SportsCenter and all you see is LeBron pounding on his chest or Djokovic ripping off his shirt or whoever it is in whatever sport. It just seems like, you know, a little bit crazy for anybody that's played sports like you and I have. You know, you win and you lose, and really you prepare as much as you personally want to or need to. You take your shot that day and you move on, right? I mean, that's what we all do. But do you think that there's a different way sports could be taught and then shown sort of in the media across the country and the world to be more collaborative than, you know, if Federer wins the U.S. Open, he took something away from me, you know, that sort of mentality?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I think, you look at the work Billie Jean King has done with World Team Tennis, you know, which is played on a professional level, but not too many people follow it.
This year was a good year for them, I thought. They had a lot of big names.
Yeah, a lot of big names. You know, Sharapova played a couple matches. Shelby Rogers, who's still alive at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
And then the efforts of World Team Tennis to move that down into the community where, you know, clubs have that format where you play single, doubles, mixed doubles, and trying to get an individual sport tennis into a team format. That's been great. My main consideration is with team sports. I would agree with your assessment that there isn't really any collaboration being taught. I think that the best thing high schools could do would be to have more sports available that are collaborative, that are non-competitive. Out here on the West Coast, for example, we're starting to see high schools now have surfing teams that don't necessarily compete against other teams, although some do. Well, you just go out and you, it's like an intramural sport where you do something together as a team and learn new skills. But there isn't, you know, wins and losses chalked up in the column or who's the scoring leader or who hit the most aces or whatever being recorded. Because let's be honest, I mean, you know, you're a tennis player. Either you win or you lose. You're out there by yourself. But 50 years from now, probably nobody's going to remember. So what does it really matter?
Cool.
And every kid wants to be the next LeBron, right, or the next, you know, Serena Williams. Mm-hmm. And that's great. Almost none of these kids are ever going to be that.
Right.
They've got to take from sports and apply it into a real-world situation where they can go out and have a good life and make some money and do good work in their community and for their family. And to the extent that we have all of these you know, high schools and colleges, so on, which all about wins and losses, it's unhealthy. I, for example, predict that, you know, football, and I'm very critical of football for kids who are young. I think things like football for young kids, and maybe even football in high school, is going to go away someday because it's not safe, you know, because of the head injuries.
Right.
And to the extent it does, you're going to have younger athletes who are looking for other opportunities to play sports that maybe aren't as competitive as that, where it's all about wins and losses and Friday night lights. But how you do that really starts with coaches. And that's what I'm trying to make. One of my criticisms of a lot of coaches is that they only care about wins and losses too. They don't care about what happens to their students or their athletes 20, 30 years down the road. And I mean, why can't high schools have basketball leagues and you know, kids who compete in basketball or other sports, baseball, where it's not all about wins and losses, where, for example, the playoffs can be based on school size regardless of what your one loss record was because you happen to be the smallest school around. You know, I have all of these weird ideas about how to make things less competitive and more collaborative. But you've got to get coaches' positions where the coaches believe in that. And I don't
like.
I've never solved the problem of how do you incentivize coaches.
Right.
Because, look, if you want to coach Duke basketball, Mike Krzyzewski, I mean, you got to win, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, he's a great coach, but if he hadn't won games, would he still be up there 40 years later? Probably not, right? Let's be frank.
Absolutely.
And it's a matter of society changing, coaches and leaders, you know, people in the community who lead these causes, changing their priorities and saying, well, maybe it's not about winning every time. It's about helping young people develop useful skills.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny. Do you know the name Colin Dibley?
Oh yeah. Why do I know that name? I read something.
He was a former top 20 ACP player. He played with Laver. He was an Aussie. He played against Laver and Newcomb, Roach, Rosewall, even into McEnroe, Nastasi, Connors. And I did a podcast with him last week. Which was a absolute blast. He turns out to live in here in Jacksonville. And I called him. I said, hey, man, can we talk for 30 minutes maximum, you know, just whatever. And so I came over to his house, and he's old. He's about 72. And
okay. It
was like having your grandpa know all of the stories that you want to know. And we talked for 2.5 hours about everything under the sun in tennis. And so I was asking him, you know, because back then Australia really dominated tennis. I mean, 8 out of the top 10 guys were Australian, and Harry Hopman was the hottest coach in the game. And he was telling me that when they all traveled, you know, and he was going to play Rosewall, you know, he would ask Newcomb, you know, you got any tips for me, or, you know, what can I do? And Newcomb would help him, and they were all sort of like that. And he was saying that, you know, if I tell you at 30 all Newcomb likes to serve out wide, doesn't mean you're going to beat him. You know, it doesn't take anything away from Newcomb. It's just making a good match. And, you know, you have a little bit of fun with it and you help each other. And the mentality that he said that they had just seemed like so much fun to be a part of. And you know, just like you just said, in 50 years, does it matter anyway? Does anybody, you know, you're still going to be the same guy, you know, probably. And you're going to have a family or not, and a house and a car, and you have to go to the grocery store still, whether you won that match or lost. And it just seems crazy that somehow sports have evolved where, you know, you can't just acknowledge another person who plays the sport and watch them do it their way and enjoy it. You know, it's like you always got to be thinking, how am I going to beat this guy? How am I going to get a leg up on him? Not even how good can I be, but how can I just be better than the next guy? And that's just, in my opinion, I think that's a little bit soul-sucking, having been through high school and college tennis, where, you know, you're just trying to keep your spot in lineup sometimes, where it's not even about enjoyment or personal growth or fulfillment or being as good as you can be. That's the last thing on your mind. You're just trying to win that match that day, which is fine if you're playing for the U.S. Open. You know, if that's what that highest level is going to be, okay, maybe you got to accept that. But for young kids in high school and even Division I, you know, relax. Have a little bit of fun and see what you can do.
But, you know, the tennis players from Spain tend to be very collaborative because a young man who I hit with up in Oceanside, who I guess you could say is my coach because I still compete in age groups, his name is Alejandro. He came over here on a college scholarship, and, you know, then he got a green card so he can work here as a tennis pro, but he grew up in the same town as Carlos Moya, who was Rafa Nadal's coach. He said all the clubs back there have these guys play for them, and they go out and play the other clubs, but it's like a big party.
Yep.
And they're all friends, and they'll give each other advice. And he said, you know, I played doubles against Nadal and with Moya. And all these guys, he said, they're actually friends, and they support each other on the tour. They want all the Spaniards to do really well professionally, and so they help each other out, like what you're saying, giving advice and mentoring, because they want Spain to be recognized as the leading country for, you know, professional tennis players.
Yeah.
And they can't do that, you know, if the best player is just a lone wolf, only looking for himself. And that's really cool to hear that. You know, to hear the guy I hit with saying, that's what we're doing in Spain, and that's probably one reason why they have so many great players, right?
Yeah.
Because they're all supporting each other instead of trying to get a leg up on each other. But, you know, we've done something cool here locally. Other running races that we've supported, we've taken away the finish line clock, and we've taken away the medals to hand out to the top few finishers. And we say, just come out and have fun and run as hard as you want, or walk with your friends, or do whatever.
Yeah.
You have whatever experience there is for you. And don't worry about whether you're running faster than the other guy in the 35 to 39 age group, or want to worry about how you're running. Worry about how you're doing compared to what your potential is, whatever time you can get to, whatever you think your best time can get, and look at it on your wristwatch. You don't need to put a clock up so that you can say you're faster than him or her or get mad because somebody beat you who you thought should, you know. In fact, why go through all of those mental gymnastics and stress? It's about just getting out and moving your body and having fun with your friends and your relatives. And who cares about medals for coming in third place in the 50 to 54 age division? I mean, seriously.
Because now that I've played futures for 2 years, the guys that play futures, I would say if you just ask somebody who knows a little bit about tennis and knows what futures are, you would think those guys are out there, every man for himself, just trying to kill the other guy. And it is like that on the court. But some of those guys that I've traveled with are the most helpful, cool guys that I've ever met. They all just want to get better. And really, that's the mentality of a lot of guys out there, that it never was like that in college. There was too much pressure. But as a professional, as a futures player, it's a little bit like, hey, you know, I hope you and I both get to be number one in the world. You know, and it's really a lot of fun, and I think it gets portrayed in the media as these guys, it's just a battle, and nobody's having any fun, nobody's enjoying it. Every day, somebody wants to quit, and of course, that part of it is there, and guys quit every day. But the majority of the guys, I would say, are out there just trying to get to the U.S. Open, and this is their one shot at being 25 and trying to make it happen, and that's what they're gonna do. And it's just it's so much fun to be in that environment that I wonder why that environment can't exist everywhere. You know, it just seems like what you're doing with your Oceanside trot is just awesome. I mean, it seems like you're really building that into a town. And if you could get a town to latch onto that, you could get a city and a state, and that would be...
It'd be cool if everybody approached it that way, but... again, I think it's how we're raised. You know, I've got a radio show, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to interview, like you're interviewing me, some guests who actually know things that are amazing, unlike me. I'm just, you know, this regular guy who's done a couple of weird things in my life, but you know, I've had people on the show. But, you know, Billie Jean King has been on my radio show.
Yeah.
Irvin Jacobs, who's the founder of a company here in San Diego called Qualcomm. Every little piece of material that's inside of your cell phone, Qualcomm made. He's, you know, the most prominent philanthropist in the history of San Diego. Sherry Harrison, whose brother owns Miami Beach, she's the Middle East only female billionaire, has been on. The great comedian Dick Van Dyke has been on. Michael Dukakis, who ran against Bush, has been on. And they all say the same thing to me. They say, you've got to find something that you're passionate about and pursue it without any specific goal in mind, like how much money you're going to make out of it or how much fame you're going to get out of it. It has to be a thing that you're passionate about that hopefully also improves the lives of people that are around you, your family, your community, the world, you know, however big you can get. And if you do that, you know, they've all told me on the show without me really talking, if you do that, you're going to find that your life was of significance, that you've contributed something to the world.
Yeah.
And so that applies to sports too.
Of course.
And if athlete, you say, well, how can I improve my game to be the best I can be, but then beyond that, how can I help others to do the same thing so they can be the best competitor and the best human being, the best community contributor they can be? And then I think you're really onto something, which is amazing how all of these people that are considered successful, they're like the most accessible people and are so willing to help others
mm-hmm.
with, you know, whatever their journey other people are on. They're not competitive. They're just collaborative by nature. And so I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, is collaboration, is it by nature or is it a learned skill? Are people able to learn it? I still haven't figured that out yet. Are people born that way? Some people are born to run fast. Everybody can do training to run faster than them. But if you're slow, Bo, you're going to be slow. You can always be faster than you were.
Yeah.
If you're born slow, it's slow. Is it the same as collaboration? Are you born to be clever? Or can you actually learn that?
Can you be raised to be collaborative, maybe?
That's the question I'm working on. That's the thing that fascinates me.
That's what I really am trying to figure out with this podcast as well, is how do people, why do people do what they do, and then what is their approach to it? And it seems like everybody that I've talked to, not everybody, but most people are, you know, just like you, trying to do something that they get, you know, they feel like they're making a meaningful impact in their lives and hopefully the lives of others. And it turns into a career sort of without them knowing it. I think that's
I mean, that's what I hope for, that somebody who takes that path, that's how it works out. And they go, wow, all that was true was real.
Yeah.
I didn't
see
it. Like one that I had in my show, Man and Burner, who's along with Aaron Jacobs, you know, a significant scientist here in San Diego. He was also the man who brought the sailing championships and everything, Dennis O'Connor and the, that crew in San Diego. He got this motto, service before self. Just three words, mm-hmm. service before. And he said he's lived his life that way. And that's allowed him to obviously contribute in amazing ways to the community. But he said he was that way when he was a 19-year-old broke kid, in college. And he said, I just followed that because he said, I believe in the law of cause and effect of the universe, that if I did good things would come my way. And if I didn't do good things wouldn't come my way.
That's crazy.
And I know it works because, the most amazing email I ever got from the dirty job. I don't know how she knew I was the founder because we don't really promote it. But in our second year, we have a lot of underserved kids, right, in our community. We've got my foundation to donate 500 pair of shoes.
Right, I heard
and
that.
And we did 1,000 pair of shoes, We didn't know how big the need was. So there was a young girl, I guess it was a freshman in high school, whose family couldn't buy her a pair of running shoes, which cost a decent pair of cost, like about $100.
Yeah.
And she got her running shoes, and she took up running, and turns out, I guess, she was really good at it, and wound up getting college scholarship, and she was the first one in her family to ever go to college. All because of a pair of shoes, getting her motivated to be an athlete, and turns out she's good, and she puts her nose, she commits to it, and I guess trains and practices college scholarship, graduates college, and now I guess she's back in the community as a significant contributor to the community clinic in Vista, which is the neighboring town. The motion side, she sent me an email saying, it wasn't for the shoes, none of this ever would have happened. I almost start crying when I, think about it or go back and read that email. I'm like, a pair of shoes did all of that?
That's
I mean, you're like, that's all it took.
Right.
All
that stood in her way was not having a pair of shoes or having a pair of shoes.
Her parents couldn't afford it. And so with that, it just moved her on her journey to become what she's becoming. And now she's going to be a great contributor back to the community, right?
Yeah.
And it just leverages itself, in ways that you can't even fathom the math of the leveraging.
That is awesome. I mean, that makes your whole, everything you do worthwhile, that right there.
Right. I told my wife, and I said, that's better than any piece of work I ever did as a CPA to get that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really do it. I was just sort of the guy, who sort of contributed some of the energy to get the thing moving. It's not like I really did anything. I just took some of my time and said, I'm going to try to do something that helps others, whatever that might be.
That's amazing.
And you're like, so in my mind, that makes me a rich person, whether I have money in the bank or not.
That's amazing.
And that's what my radio is about. I mean, we're the only financial show that never talks about money. We talk about health, people, knowledge, relationships, community involvement, philanthropy, legacy, all those things that we think make people truly wealthy. I mean, you could be a billionaire, Bo, but if your three kids are drug addicts, your life is going to be miserable. You'll have money to pay for medical bills, but you're not going to be having any fun or doing any good work in the world. You're going to just be miserable because of that. All the money won't change it. You've got to have health and relationships and collaborative relationships and community. And if you have those things, then you might, truly be wealthy.
And I think
our show is well because it's different.
That's amazing. I just wrote an article last night sort of defending Nick Kyrgios. Did you hear his press conference after his first-round loss? If you just know his antics.
Yeah, Nick is an amazing talent who sometimes goes sideways on the court and or in public.
Right. And he's just crazy the way that people will just rip this guy down. He's just a 22-year-old guy. I mean, what 22-year-old isn't questioning, hey, is this what I want to do? Whether you're a CPA or a tennis player or still in college, when you're 22, that's what you think. Hey, what can I be doing?
Yeah.
And I think it's such a bad example for the media and the commentators to just tear this guy down who will lose a match and says, hey, it's not the end of the world. And, Federer says that same thing, but maybe because Kyrgios has slumped over and just his whole demeanor makes it a little bit different, maybe. But, when Federer says that, people will say, oh, he's so humble and he knows his spot in the world. Isn't that great? And if Kyrgios says it, it's like, you want him to live and die by the outcome of this match. It's just
too much. It's
crazy. And I would encourage you to keep on if you're 1,500 in the world. I doubt that I'm the 1,500 best CPA in the world, but I keep on being a CPA. But I have a feeling. I was playing a really good agent player last week, and the guy hits his moving serve to my forehand, and I hit it back, and he volleys it from my backhand corner. And I try to hit a passing shot, but he hits like this little half volley, like I'm charging into the net and hit a winner down the line. And it's like the most amazing feeling. The people in the court next to us are watching this. They started clapping. It was the most, you know, amazing display of tennis that two old guys in their 50s could possibly put on for one time. But it felt so good to be able to do it, right? And I'm thinking to myself, I'm actually still playing, paying money to go play tennis, right? At least you can make a few bucks at 1,500 in the world, right? But,
yeah.
You know, I'm actually paying money to go play tennis because I love it so much. And the reason I love it so much is because we can participate in points like that. It's such high quality. You know, my friend, he goes, golly, Richard, great shot. You know, and then when he hit the go winner a few points later, I'm like, geez, Mitch, that was a great shot. You know, we're totally collaborative, just having fun. You guys just trading winners for an hour and a half. You know what I mean?
That's awesome.
And
that's the way it should
be. Like, I hope I can do this for, you know, like, I hope my body holds out so I can do this for the rest of my life.
Right.
The feeling of just, you know, on a full run, hitting a winner down the line or cross court, or seeing the guy you're playing do it off of one of your great shots. It's just such a blast, you know? And you know the feeling. That's why, yeah, I'm a big curious man. I'm like, he's going to be great. You just have to get through some bumps in the road, and people should frankly just leave the guy alone. He doesn't need moral judgment.
All right, that'll do it for my episode and my interview with Richard Musio. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I appreciate you sticking through all the way. I know the sound quality is so bad. I'm going to do my best to not let that happen again. But I'm sure if you're still listening now, you know that interview was too good and there was too much to learn for me to not post it. Tomorrow, actually, I'm doing a podcast with Scoville Jenkins, a former top American prospect tennis player. He played Roddick, Rafa, Federer at the U.S. Open. He got to 198 in singles, and then he never made it higher than that. And now he's the assistant coach at the University of Wisconsin for their men's tennis team, and I'm going to be talking to him tomorrow. So that interview will come out next Sunday. Of course, if you have anybody that you want me to interview, send me a message. Give me an idea of somebody, and I'll try to get in touch with them as best I can. And then, as always, it would really help me if you like and subscribe to my podcast on iTunes. That's what can keep this going, help me make a little bit of money, and just overall get it a little bit more popular. You know, every time you like it and share it on Facebook and Instagram or Twitter, that really means the world to me at this point. And it always, you know, it always will when somebody likes what I'm doing and wants to share it. That'd be great. So if you guys could do that for me, that would be amazing. But until next time, y'all, I hope you have a good week. Thanks for listening. Man, I can tell by the look in your face. As you was digging it, I'm thinking, okay, we should close our tab and we should head that way. Yeah, you have me like, hold up, what's going on? Where you from? Did you come with a group or did your friends not come? And there's a lot of girls here, but you're the prettiest one. So, put your number in my phone, cause I ain't going home alone, hey. And I mean this in the best way, but you're gonna be my worst case scenario. Yeah, and I don't know what's gotten into me. Something to do with you. All of a sudden I got some energy. Yeah, I don't wanna waste it all on you. Yeah. Okay, I woke up in the morning, I was sober, rolled over and saw you laying right here in this bed. Hey. And I don't really know what happened. In my head I started laughing, so I tapped you on the shoulder instead. Yeah, you had me like, hold up, what's going on? Where you from? Did I come with a group or did my friends not come? There were a lot of girls there, you weren't the prettiest one. But take my number on your phone. Hey, I'm about to take the cab along, can I mean this in the best way, but this is my worst case scenario, yeah, I'm